I'd like to welcome John C. Franklin, a professor of classics at the University of Vermont, who currently teaches Greek and Latin language, literature, and especially epic lyric and comedy. John's work has dealt with actually recreating music, which is an incredible talent and skill, which I obviously can't speak to myself. John, thank you so much for accepting my invitation to come on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for reaching out to me, Andreas. I appreciate it.
You actually started your life in music composition, and then you switched to classics. And that has sort of, I mean, obviously that background has lent itself very nicely to the work that you do with musical interface between, you know, early Greece and the Near East. And you recreate compositions of Greek music, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
That's incredible. I've seen some of those videos, and to be able to recreate something that ostensibly is lost, but in a way that is very engaging, you know, it's incredible.
Thanks. Well, my doctoral work was connecting a body of cuneiform, you know, Babylonian musical tablets to the earliest Greek lyre evidence. And so the history of the lyre and its conceptualization is sort of the thread that runs through all this. That's what led me to look at the divine lyre. In terms of the musical reconstructions, there's a number of people that perform on replicas now and that work on ancient Greek music. What I like to do is I play some of the surviving fragments of Greek music. You know, there's a few dozen. But mostly I like to compose new ancient music, I call it, based on the ancient meter of surviving texts. So Euripides' Helen is one of the ones I've done most with. So you're interpreting the original meter. So that gets you pretty close to what it sounded like rhythmically. Then you've got to compose new melodies and use tunings on the lyres and so on. So those are based on ancient sources and principles so far as possible. But there's a kind of a Spinal Tap element to what I do. You know, we try to entertain. I've got an electric kinaru that's based on a Bronze Age ivory plaque from Megiddo. And, you know, I've got a sea people's hat. And, you know, so it gets a little silly, a little Ren Fairy. But, you know, I find it probably the most rewarding thing I've done academically, because it brings together both my creative side and my academic side. And I have a band now called The Call of Kinaru. Kinaru is the, you know, the Ugaritic lyre god. The Call of Kinaru, it's a four-piece band with some of my favorite people that I've met, and we have a great time doing that.
Very, very cool. But for today, we're here to talk about something that I'm admittedly not too familiar with. I'm vaguely familiar with, and that is the epic cycle, amongst other things, but the epic cycle and how it relates to Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Now, before we jump into that, I like to contextualize the period just to kind of wrap my head around what's happening historically. So I was hoping that before we dive right into that, can you tell listeners what this sub-Mycenaean period was, and whether or not this corresponds archaeologically to the Bronze Age collapse? What do we know about this period?
Well, I'd refer listeners to another podcast in your series by Maria Yakovu, which is a really excellent sort of up-to-date synthesis or overview of a lot of the issues of interpretation and of evidence. And I think she begins rightly by stressing that, material culture doesn't speak. And so it's open to a number of interpretations. And traditionally, Cyprus has been looked at as a receptive matrix to outside cultural influences. But in fact, it's, more recent scholars have supported a properly Cyprocentric view of Cypriot culture as its own distinct entity and so on. She begins, though, by saying that sort of whatever interpretation one adopts of the material record, and that's the primary evidence for understanding the Late Bronze Age and the Iron Age, so-called, you know, and those are somewhat artificial distinctions, those labels. It's really in terms of time, it's a continuum. But one has to somehow arrive at the earliest written records, which are in the Greek language. So that's the Esarhaddon inscription, for instance. That's not a Greek record, but it's a Neo-Assyrian one that gives the names of some of the kings, which are Greek, as far as we can reconstruct them. And then the historical inscriptions on Cyprus itself are in the Greek language, and also a large body in Phoenician as well. But the point is that one has to come up with some historical explanation that allows for the presence of and the influx of the Greek language to the island. Now, there could be a variety of ways of explaining that. And what Iacovu does in that podcast is to deconstruct the older narrative of Mycenaean colonization seen as a sort of, in a 19th century understanding of colonization as a superior dominant political power asserting itself somewhere else and controlling. And more recent scholarship thinks more in terms of population movements and influx and gradual infiltration and so on. So there's a fairly distinct shift in recent scholarship on that front. But again, as you and I are moving towards talking about the epic cycle, we have to somehow or other account for the influx of the Greek language and whatever that might mean in cultural terms.
So what would Cyprus be like at the time archaeologically? And I know this is outside of your expertise, but archaeologically, what is happening in Cyprus?
Well, I mean, in terms of some of the things that have traditionally been cited as evidence of Mycenaean cultural influx, for instance, some examples would be the continued use of chariot warfare, which disappears in mainland Greece, but which Herodotus, describes as happening on Cyprus during the Persian Wars. Kings that have religious duties, which seem to go out in Greece. The ancient title of Wanax, which is a Mycenaean term, but undergoes a change of meaning or application on Cyprus, but it's nevertheless a continued Mycenaean word. Those are three examples of, that have been used to support the narrative of colonization. But even if you take out that traditional idea of colonization, you're still looking at these features of Mycenaean, features that were, they were current in the Mycenaean period and that seemed to continue within the island. Now, it's, for instance, with chariot warfare, no doubt that was also practiced on the island. Literacy was lost with Linear B in Greece, but it continues on the island because the island had its own form of script, which was distantly related to Linear B. So there, too, you could see a sort of continuity. Even if the Mycenaeans lost their own administrative script, they were able to, in some sense, continue by coming to a land, Cyprus, that had its own comparable apparatus. So in some ways, you could regard whatever the state of material culture on Cyprus at the transition from Bronze to Iron Age, it was a sort of sympathetic matrix. It was matrix is probably the wrong word. It has literally a womb is probably, some of the implications are maybe not so desirable, but it was an environment in which some of the cultural practices of the Mycenaean period found a hospitable environment to continue to develop, by all means in a different direction, but permitting a degree of continuity that might not have been equally possible in parts of Greece.
So let's dive into the nitty gritty here. I remember loving to read Greek mythology. And when I realized when I was a little bit older that there was some related foundation myths from Cyprus in its relation to Greek mythology, I was even more drawn to them. And what I was hoping you could do is maybe if you don't mind sharing with listeners, what are some of those foundation myths? And more importantly, perhaps, what's their significance? Like, why is it so important that Cyprus would have these foundation myths that we've come to know?
Okay, sure. There's quite a wide variety of these, and in most cases, it would be optimistic to really describe them as foundation myths. They're figures that are named in connection with founding some site on Cyprus, but often it's just a name. So for instance, the late epic poet Nonnus, when referring to the marshalling of the Cypriot kings behind Dionysus in his, in his Dionysiaca, it's a late epic, but he refers to a king called Lithros and another called Lapithos. And these are transparently connected with those sites of Lydra and Lapithos. But there's no other detail given to suggest that there was any kind of proper story behind these names. They appear just to be coined names coined from the sites themselves, what we would call an eponymous hero, in order simply to provide, you know, who was the mythological era leader of, you know, Lapithos. Well, it was the guy called Lapithos. You know, it's the sort of the easiest way to come up with something, right? So there's a category of these figures that don't have much to them like that. Then you've got other ones similar as a character called Golgos, who's an eponym for Golgoi. And so that doesn't seem to have much more to it. However, we're given the detail that he migrated from Sicyon in the Peloponnese. No further detail than that, but it's a peculiar detail. Why Sicyon? It implies something specific, some further specific detail that hasn't survived into the source that we have for it, which in many cases are things like ancient dictionaries that will just give the name of somebody or other very truncated sources. So in that case, we may reasonably infer some kind of a story behind it that ties it for some reason to Sicyon. Sicyon's in the Peloponnese, which was the sort of the heartland of Mycenaean culture, of the Arcadian dialect as well, which is connected to Cyprus, the Cypro-Arcadian dialect. So maybe there's something else a little deeper there, but we don't have any further details. There's another category. We hear about Laconians, again from the Peloponnese, coming from Therapna in connection with founding Lapithos, and someone called Cepheus with Achaeans who's coming from Olenos and Dume. These are from Lycophron, a Hellenistic poet who, you know, like many Hellenistic poets, is concerned to display their deep learning and their obscure learning. So they liked to find regional epicoric traditions and details and weave them into their poetry as a display of learning. And it's of a piece with the Hellenistic period that they are reaching into these local traditions and kind of synthesizing them. It's part of the cosmopolitanism of that period. So in the case of the ones I just cited, these are very obscure names. They don't occur in the catalog of ships. They're not in Homer. The places they come from, Olenos, Dume, Therapna, have no obvious historical connection with Cyprus or really anything else that you can point to. So the very obscurity and specificity of those citations supports the idea that there's something historical about them. Because usually when an ancient source is fabricating a tradition, it's in order to connect it to something much better known, for instance, Homer. In this case, it's one of the rhetorical argumentative devices you use in scholarship is to say that the very obscurity of this supports its authenticity. So I guess I would invoke that there. And we do know that Lycophron drew on Hellenistic scholars like Eratosthenes and Philostephanus that did this kind of ethnographic regional work. So that's kind of interesting. Those suggest the obscurity of those traditions suggests that they derive from Cyprus itself and may reflect local traditions about immigration from Greece, or at the very least, local Cypriot attempts to tie themselves back to Greece, even if they were not in possession of authentic traditions. In other words, inventing a tradition for their own past. I'm inclined to think that they probably do go back to actual popular traditions.
You know, I'm actually reminded of King Evagoras the First, who I believe claimed direct descent from Teucer. There's something to be said about the need to make that claim, right? I mean, what would it do? Does it legitimize Greek rule? Or I shouldn't say Greek rule, but does it legitimize rule? Does it tell people, look how far back my descent goes. This is why I am in the position and the authority that I claim.
That's right. It can be a claim of antiquity of authority for sure, and it can also be a claim of a specific political alignment. So, for instance, we hear about two characters called Acamas and Demophon that are sons of Theseus that found Soloi, and we know there was a tradition connecting the Athenian Solon also to that site, and that in his 10 years of self-imposed exile after giving law at Athens, that he went to Cyprus and specifically to Soloi. And we know that there was a number of Athenian imperial interventions or attempted interventions on Cyprus in the 5th century. So some scholars, including Einar Gerstad, who wrote a seminal article on these traditions, would see some of these Athenocentric traditions as deriving from that 5th century political contact. And you could maybe put the Evagoras one of Salamis in there as well, because he was closely politically oriented with Athens in the late 5th century. And, you know, he's on the one hand deriving his descent from Teucer, who's connected with Salamis, which is an Athenian holding at that point. And on the other hand, from a daughter of Cinyras. So that's a sort of potentially trying to tie himself to the pre-Greek or indigenous dimension of the island, going back to the, you know, the mythical period of the golden age of the island, when it was all under the rule of one king, Cinyras, according to the mythological construction of the past. So that's, those are good examples of what you talk about of legitimacy.
Before we go into Nostoi, can you tell us what those are? And are these foundational stories rooted in this literary body of work?
Yeah, so Nostos means homecoming. And so it comes to be, you know, and the associated verb is the normal verb for getting home in the Odyssey. And the term comes to be used of the various stories relating to the Greek heroes at Troy when they return home. And the most famous one is, of course, the Odyssey. But within the Odyssey itself, we hear about the homecoming of Menelaus. He talks about his wanderings in the Eastern Mediterranean, including Cyprus, and we'll probably come back to that later. But there's Agamemnon, of course, has a very different kind of homecoming. He gets home and is not awaited by his faithful wife, and so on. So Nostoi as a category, and as the name of one of the epic cycle poems, or sort of the, well, we have to talk about the difference between specific poems and a kind of a phase of the mythological arc, you know. So this is the post-Trojan War homecoming arc. And you could tell those stories in a lot of different ways. And generically speaking, you could call those all Nostoi. But there was also a specific title called Nostoi that was part of the epic cycle that is summarized for us in some ancient sources. So that's what Nostoi is generally. As far as Cyprus goes, I mean, maybe one of the, a further example that does lead us towards the epic cycle in Homer, you know, in the more narrower sense, is Agapenor at Paphos. He does occur in the catalog of ships in Homer, but he doesn't play any other part in the Iliad or the Odyssey. So that is a curious fact. It means he wasn't really part of the mainstream Greek tradition, but... Right, because he's not out there on the battlefield with Diomedes and everyone else. He doesn't have a mythology there. But it was considered important by the poet of the Iliad to include him in the catalog of ships. That means he was a figure of some, you know, with regional authority. So he needed to be included because at Paphos there were traditions about Agapenor. And so that implies a pretty early horizon for Agapenor being a migration figure within Cypriot lore itself, even if we don't have any direct evidence for a Nostos poem about his coming to Cyprus. We do have some later sources that refer to it, but whether it ever existed as a Homeric style narrative or not, we can't be sure. But and then this gets to a more general problem of, you know, these earlier centuries on Cyprus that we're interested in, as you know, historical population movements and popular traditions recalling them, none of that is captured in any written source. And we only start getting evidence for those traditions in the Hellenistic period, which is, you know, so as I mentioned, Eratosthenes and Philostephanus, these guys are writing 4 or 5 centuries after Homer. So even though we might think it likely that some of these traditions do go back to that early migration period, we're stuck with a kind of an interpretive problem in that our sources are so late. Therefore, a lot of people would like to dismiss them as being secondary. So that's a whole, you know, famous kind of problem with interpreting ancient sources that maybe you want to come back to later.
We erroneously make this assumption that Homeric works are written works, which is would be an incorrect assumption. What do we know about these epic traditions in Iron Age Greece? Like, Were they performed? Did they have a religious element to them? What's the current consensus on the existence of a Homer? Can you just contextualize all that for us?
Sure. I mean, these are all different dimensions of the so-called Homeric problem. And I remember asking my doctoral advisor 25 years ago the same question: what's the current consensus on the existence of a Homer? And he said, the current consensus is there is no consensus. That's Richard Yanko. And that remains true today. It's such a multiform problem. The different answers are possible. I mean, two broad schools, I guess, would be that Homer, the name itself, is a speaking name. That is, it's a sort of symbolic name. It can be etymologized as joining together, home, and then the root ar, arisco, to join. And so that Homer is the joiner of verses. And so the name itself kind of tells you that he's a sort of a mythological figure that is sort of an umbrella figure for this broader oral tradition. Now, another school would say, yes, there is a multiform, very deep oral tradition with hundreds, maybe thousands of poets over the generations contributing to it. But Homer can still be an individual poet that is giving us a specific version, his versions of these stories. And those scholars would counter the etymological argument, saying that there's nothing implausible about the name Homer having a musical etymology, because there's many other examples from Greek sources of professional musicians having such professionally relevant names. For instance, Stesichorus means the guy that stands the chorus or gets a chorus going. And there's, or Terpander, the man that gives delight. These are the kind of names you might want to have as a professional when you show up in somebody's town to perform. So, those are two of the kind of data points or argument points that people often bring forward talking about the historical Homer. So I, like many people, just sort of sidestep that issue on the grounds that we have two poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, that are real poems with real words, and real content, sort of proceed from that material. And then the epic cycle and its fragments are from that same world. They're just not completely intact the way the Iliad and the Odyssey are.
What was the significance this body of literature? I mean, were they performed and did they have a religious element to them?
Sure. So, these are like so many things about early Greek culture. There's deductions based on what evidence we have, and the evidence is all too often incomplete. So what we can do, for instance, is we can start by looking at scenes of epic performance within the Iliad and the Odyssey themselves. One case would be the bard. Some people don't like to use the word bard because it's a Celtic term, but aoidos is the Greek word, singer, in the Odyssey, who performs on the island of the Phaeacians. And he sings about the conflict between Achilles and Odysseus is an episode that he sings, and it makes Odysseus cry. He is somebody that has to be called to the palace, apparently, from outside the palace. So he's in the community, but he's not resident in the palace. Is this an accurate portrait? Probably. His name means Demotic. Demoticus means welcome by the people. So that sort of implies something that's not restricted to the palace, but is sort of more broadly demotic in terms of appeal and performance context. Phemius is also in the Odyssey. He's the bard at Odysseus's palace, and his name is connected with stems about speaking. And so he's sort of, he's a person that describes or bestows fame or story. So palatial environment is definitely one plausible, or any sort of hall of a chieftain or any concentrated seat of power would be one logical place we would seek epic song at feasts and so on. But among communities as well, in particular in connection with festivals, regional festivals. So in the Homeric hymn to Apollo, and this is again epic verse. So like the Odyssey, like the Iliad, like the epic cycle itself, we have the Homeric hymns. These are the same meter, the same diction, many of the same themes, but they're each addressed to or concerned with a specific divinity. So in the hymn to Apollo, there's a famous, much discussed passage about the Gods Festival on Delos and how Ionians from all over the Ionian part of the Aegean will converge on that island for that festival and hear these kinds of songs. So festivals would be another major environment for that. And finally, I guess we should mention the idea of guilds of singers, like the Homeridae, which word means sons of Homer or descendants of Homer. These would be professional groups of singers that would have their own sort of in-house versions of poems. Perhaps they would possess an early written text of the Iliad or the Odyssey, that's possible, that they would then reproduce in a specific form by traveling to different festivals. And it might be that sort of a mechanism that eventually accounts for why the Iliad and the Odyssey per se, these specific poems, become the canonical texts that they become by the end of the 6th century or the beginning of the 5th century. To summarize, we've got palace or other great house environments, festivals, and then the professionalism of the singers themselves, you know, purveying their craft in these different environments.
Now, we mentioned, obviously, the epic cycle a couple times so far, and most are familiar with the Iliad and the Odyssey, but can you tell us what some of these lost texts are that make up the epic cycle? How much of them do we possess, and how do classicists reconstruct them?
Okay, great. Yeah, it's a complex and fascinating area that I think a lot of people would be interested in, but students of Greek literature, for instance, don't often get to study because the texts are fragmentary and classrooms tend to concentrate on continuous texts. But anyway, in terms of the term itself, epic cycle, we could sort of, it could have a couple of applications. An earlier, broader one that corresponds to the oral phase of this tradition, and then a narrower one that corresponds to the later written phase. So if we start with that oral phase, we could use the term simply to refer to all of the stories that relate to the Trojan War cycle. So from the judgment of Paris and the apple of discord to the abduction of Helen, the raising of the Greek fleet, the sacrifice of Iphigenia at Aulis, the false landing in the battle against Telephus, the final landing at Troy, then the subject matter of the Iliad. The Iliad, of course, breaks off before the fall of Troy. So there was the phase that dealt with the death of Achilles himself and the taking of Troy, and then the return home of Odysseus, and then the other heroes also coming home in other homecoming poems or nostoi. So if you put yourself maybe back in the 10th century or the 9th century, before we have any written texts, you imagine singers telling different versions of all these stories. And they might, you know, a given singer might select one phase of that arc or cycle and say, oh, I'm going to talk about the homecoming of Diomedes, or I'm going to talk about what happened after Odysseus got home, or I'm going to talk about the judgment of Paris and the abduction of Helen. So within the oral tradition, all of these motifs can be selected for development. So potentially, there could be thousands of versions of these. Now, if we zoom forward a century or two and we start getting things written down, and that's a complex question we could go into, but eventually you do get written versions of these texts because we have them. We have the Iliad and the Odyssey and fragments of these other poems. Then you have to imagine specific tellings, you know, some specific poet dictating or writing down a specific version of a traditional story. And that's what the Odyssey is. Homer didn't make it all up. He was telling the story of Odysseus that was traditional. What we have is his specific version of that story. Okay, so in this later phase, we would use epic cycle to refer to the cobbling together of specific instantiations of each of these phases. And this is maybe something that happened in the Hellenistic period when Alexandrian and other Hellenistic scholars wanted to create a coherent epic cycle. Jonathan Burgess has done good work on this in Toronto, as it happens, maybe somebody to follow up with. He has the view, which I think is right, that Alexandrian scholars, or some few specific ones, took traditional poems that corresponded to the different phases of this story cycle and molded them a little bit, maybe chopped off the ending of one to fit the start of another one. So for instance, the Iliad only goes up to the death of Achilles. And then you have to find another poem that will pick up the story from there. Maybe that poem that you find also deals with earlier events preceding, it only goes up to the sack of Troy and the death of Patroclus and not the death of Achilles. So if you want to pick it up and talk about the death of Achilles, which is narrated in the poem called the Aethiopis, you have a poem called that, and it deals with the death of Achilles, but maybe it also deals with things that were covered by the Iliad. You therefore would truncate the beginning of that poem and make it fit or adjoin the end of Homer's text. And so the epic cycle in that narrow sense is a sort of curated collection of traditional stories in specific tellings that were then edited to create one kind of canonical version of this cycle. And our knowledge of that canonical version goes back to summaries by Proclus and Pseudo-Apollodorus. These are, you know, two later figures that seem to have had a continuous set of texts in front of them, and they summarize what was contained in them. And so we know at least the plot of those other poems. They identify besides the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Aethiopis, which I mentioned before, which deals with the death of Achilles, the Ethiopian king Memnon, the Amazonian queen Penthesilea. There was another one called the Little Iliad, which dealt with how Troy would finally be taken through getting the bow of Heracles back from Philoctetes, by bringing Achilles' son Neoptolemus from the island of Scyros, by capturing the Palladian, which was a sort of Athena amulet that was protecting Troy. And then there's the Iliopersis, or destruction or sack of Troy, which dealt with the Trojan horse. And then, of course, the Nostoi, which was the homecomings, and a final phase called the Telegony, which deals a very strange set of stories dealing with the death of Odysseus and his son Telegonus. Not Telemachus, but another son that he had with Circe called Telegonus. So that kind of takes you from the judgment of Paris all the way to the death of the story of Odysseus's son. And that whole arc is what we call the epic cycle.
And then, of course, there's the Kypria, which is, as you mentioned, starts with the judgment of Paris, I believe, and right. Which is very relevant for the History of Cyprus podcast.
That's right.
So what evidence do we have for the Kypria's existence? And who are some of those first authors that mentioned the Kypria? I think you may have mentioned one or two of them. What events are essentially covered?
So, besides these summaries of the epic cycle that we have, we also have a number of specific fragments attributed to these different poems. Fragments are when an ancient author says, as Stasinus wrote in the Kypria, blah, 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 and he quotes a line or two, and then goes on. And so those fragments are a second set of evidence for these lost poems, and they're collected in a number of fragment collections that the scholars consult. So the Kypria, as you say, deals with the phase of the epic cycle from the beginning, from the wedding of Peleus and Thetis, from which Eris was excluded. So she has the apple of discord and, to the fairest, and then there's the judgment of Paris and so on. So it covers all of that. So Paris gives the prize to Aphrodite in exchange for getting Helen. Aphrodite then leads Paris to, according to the narrative of the Cypria, she goes with Paris to Sparta. Paris abducts Helen, or in some versions, Helen runs off of her own free will, and they go back to Troy. Menelaus finds out, he raises the fleet, and they go to Troy, and then the Trojan War begins. So all of that was covered in the Cypria. But there's a really fascinating problem with this, which is that Herodotus, who is one of our earliest surviving Greek authors, 5th century, mid-5th century BC, he tells us that although some people believed the Cypria was written by Homer, that cannot be the case, because Homer refers to Paris and Helen going to Sidon, the Phoenician city of Sidon. And there's a passage in the Iliad that refers to weaver women that work for the Trojan palace that Paris brought back from Sidon. So Homer himself knows that Paris went to the Eastern Mediterranean on his way back from Sparta with Helen. Herodotus, however, says that Homer could not have written the Cypria because the Cypria has a couple of verses saying that Paris and Helen went straight back to Troy with a fair wind and smooth seas. And from this, he reasonably concludes that Homer didn't write the Cypria because Homer believes they didn't go straight back to Troy. Now, here's where the problem comes in. In that summary of the Cypria from Proclus and Pseudo-Apollodorus, that summary tells us that Paris and Helen did go to the Eastern Mediterranean. In other words, the summary is in alignment with Homer and disagrees with the Cypria that was known to Herodotus. So we've got a Herodotus saying, the Cypria says they go straight to Troy, and the summary is saying, no, the Cypria says they didn't go straight to Troy. So there's two lost versions of this poem, or two poems going under the same name that tell different versions of what happened. So that's quite interesting. And what the key point for me is that to Homer, already, you know, Homer's our earliest source. He's two, three centuries earlier than Herodotus. Homer assumes and considers it normal that Paris and Helen did travel in the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, Sidon is just across the strait from Cyprus, so we'll get back to how Cyprus figures into this. But Homer is our valuable evidence that these traveling stories set in the lands around Cyprus were a traditional and very early feature of the epic cycle tradition, and that Herodotus, for whatever reason, knew a later version of the poem that had excised or eliminated these episodes. And Jonathan Burgess, again, I refer to him again, offers, in connection with this poem and some of the other epic cycle poems, what I think is the correct explanation, which is that as the Iliad and the Odyssey achieved canonical status and were recited at pan-Hellenic festivals, versions of the epic cycle that had too many kind of regional details that would be obscure to a pan-Hellenic or general Greek audience, those kind of episodes were gradually excluded, and there became a sort of more streamlined version of events that would be familiar to the most number of people. And so at some point, I believe an older version of the Cypria lost all of its episodes that were centered around the Eastern Mediterranean.
Is that why it would have been given the name the Cypria? Because of the events that happened during Paris and Helen's wanderings in the Eastern Mediterranean, which would eventually bring them to Cyprus? Is the reason why it's called Cypria simply because of its authorship? I know you've actually addressed this. You mentioned that some skeptics say, and I quote here, the title alone might have begotten false Cypriot attributions.
Right.
But as you mentioned earlier in this interview, the obscurity of the names inspires that confidence that it does have historical basis. Basically, where does Cyprus kind of fit in to the name the Cypria?
Okay, good. That's a great question. And it's still a conundrum. I mean, the easiest view is that Cypria is a neuter plural adjective and that it agrees with an assumed epe, so the Cypriot verses. A number of other epic cycle titles have this pattern. So Cypria would be the Cypriot verses. The question then, that's really what it needs to mean. We'll come back to a bogus etymology that it's from a guy's name whose name was Cyprias. That's also very interesting, but the reasonable conclusion is that it means the Cypriot verses. The question is then, what is Cypriot about these verses? Is it the content, because there's adventures around Cyprus? Or is it the authorship, whoever wrote these things was from Cyprus, whether the poem contained material relating to Cyprus or not? Okay, so that's a kind of a crux. And we do have authorial traditions that this poem was written by a Cypriot author. There's actually two of them. One is Hegesinos and the other is Stasinus. And Stasinus, at least, is said to be from Salamis on Cyprus. So that's, again, I appeal to the argument of obscurity and specificity. We don't know anything else about this guy aside from the fact that Athenaeus, a later source, says that he composed the Cypria and that he was from Salamis. It's not the kind of thing you would necessarily make up. So when something odd and inexplicable kind of survives through the processes of transmission, during which all the rough edges tend to be worn off of things. If something survives with a few rough edges like this, we should pay attention to it. So I think it's likely that some version of this poem did come from a Cypriot singer. However, I think it's also likely that this version contained episodes of adventure concerning the island and the regions around it. And that's not so surprising. You know, those two things, it might sound like I'm trying to have it both ways, but those two things coexist very well, because a singer from Cyprus composing a poem, at least partially for consumption on the island, is naturally going to tell stories of regional interest to people on the island, right? It's sort of the opposite of why they were excluded later on back in Greece, where people didn't really know much about Cyprus and the lands around it. People on Cyprus itself would be much more interested in those adventures. So I do think that the title indicates both Cypriot authorship and a fairly extensive treatment of regional wandering adventures, because we do have a lot of fragments and attestations about adventures like this. And this is, I think, where they happened.
These are the famous wandering myths that I read so much about. And this is the Proclean version.
That's correct.
And, okay. And
well, I was going to say, just to sort of polish that off in case anyone was worried about it, the third attribution is to somebody called Kyprias, which is a personal name. And, you know, that's a transparent secondary fabrication from the title Kypria. So it's like, who wrote the Kypria? Oh, this guy, Kyprias. And we even have traces of a sort of a bogus argument saying that Kypria, the title, is a Doric genitive singular, meaning the poems of Kyprias, right? This was Mr. Kyprias's poem. But what's remarkable about it is that, you know, that the very name Kyprias assumes the title Kypria. So that the title has to be explained first. But somebody thought it was important to invent this person as the writer. And the motivation for doing so is to explain the title, right? The idea that you you can connect it to this Herodotean or later version of the poem that lacks the Cyprus episodes. People would be like, why is it called Kypria? There's no Cyprus episodes, and nothing to do with Cyprus. Oh, it's because it belongs to this guy, Kyprias. It's Kyprias's poem. Now that might sound a little far-fetched, but this Kyprias is from the city of Halicarnassus, which is exactly where Herodotus is from. So Herodotus knew a version of the poem from the town of Halicarnassus, where it was attributed to this guy Kyprias. And so it's sort of like it's like the traditional title Kypria had to be somehow acknowledged, but it was reinterpreted to be by this fake guy Kyprias in order to explain why it didn't have any Cypriot content anymore. So why exactly that happened in Halicarnassus is impossible to say, but the pieces are so weird and they fit together so well that really lets us exclude the Herodotean version as a secondary development and lets us focus on these kind of earlier tales that Homer obviously knew about.
Just for my own clarity, you know, you mentioned Stasinor as being the author. Now, is Stasinor the first to have written down the tale, and is it ultimately Homer's story that Stasinor is recording, or is this a story that developed in the epic cycle tradition that has nothing to do with Homer? It's just another one of those added stories to the epic cycle.
Right. I mean, that we can't really say. So the name is Stasinus, although Stasinor is another Cypriot name. But names with Stas are very well attested in Cypriot inscriptions. So that also supports the historicity of a Salaminian poet called Stasinus. But, you know, I can't really answer your question. You know, the specificity of the name indicates that he was a real person. But when was he writing? Probably later than Homer. In that case, he probably knew Homer, in which case, when he composed his episode, he may have, kept Homer in mind and fitted himself to it. That we can't really say. What we can say, I think, on the basis of Homer's allusion to Paris and Helen's wanderings, is that these stories were traditional, so that when somebody like Stasinus wrote them up, he gave a version of these traditional stories, even if, as a post-Homeric writer, he had to take Homer's specific versions into account in formulating his older traditional material. This is an interpretive problem that plagues all interpretation of the epic cycle. The question of a specific version of a story versus a traditional, the story as a traditional entity and then a specific telling of that traditional story. Those are, you've got a generic class and then a specific instance. And we can rarely be certain of which one we're dealing with when we're talking about evidence for the epic cycle.
Paris and Helen, they wander the Eastern Mediterranean and they make it to Cyprus. What really happens?
So if we're talking about Paris and Helen, in the summary from Proclus, we're told that when Paris and Helen were on their way back to Troy, Hera sent a storm that interrupted their journey and blew them to Sidon. So this is now the presence of a storm encourages us to see this as a traditional story, because storms were a convenient and traditional narratological or storytelling device. So they happen in the Odyssey, for instance. Whenever a hero or anybody is traveling from point A to point B, you can interrupt that journey and take them wherever you want simply by having a divine storm thrown in there. So for instance, when Menelaus is on his way back from Troy, according to the Odyssey, a storm blows up around Crete and he is blown off to Libya and then spends 7 years wandering in the Eastern Mediterranean. So when we hear from the Proclan summary that Paris and Helen were blown by a storm sent by Hera to the Eastern Mediterranean, that sounds traditional. That's a plausible traditional story. Now, there's another source called Dictys of Crete. It's a second century AD Greek source that survives only in a Latin epitome. In other words, we don't have the original Greek poem, but we have a Latin version of it. He gives a similar kind of story, except that this time the storm doesn't blow Paris and Helen to Sidon, but it takes them first to Cyprus. Okay, so this is quite a late source. So a lot of scholars will say, this Dictys of Crete, there's a fictional conceit that he was one of the followers of Idomeneus of Crete, and that this is his story that was uncovered, from a temple or a deposit, and now we know the true story of what happened. So, this is a known dimension of imperial era mythography, that you kind of invent ancient sources, and so that does raise some suspicions. However, a poem like this, despite being late, draws on traditional material. So the question then becomes, what is traditional and what is innovated by the second century AD author? In the case of this storm that blows them to Cyprus, the answer is we don't know and we can't say. However, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of a storm is a traditional device. And we have it in that Proclan summary of the Cypria taking them to Sidon. So this one is of more interest to us for Cyprus because it takes them directly to Cyprus. We don't hear much about what happens there other than that Paris acquired a certain number of ships. And he used these ships to cruise down into Phoenicia and he slew the king of the Sidonians at night, who had received him in friendship. And then he sacked the whole house, which is what Paris usually does. When he took Helen from Sparta, he also robbed the palace of all its treasure. So, that's not a lot of detail, but it does seem to be too specific to me to have been simply made up by Dictys. To me, it sounds like it's summarizing an earlier version that was more extensive. So, for instance, a number of plausible inferences are possible. When you come to when wandering heroes come to a new destination, they're typically hosted by the local king or person who's in power. And so who would that be for Cyprus? Who do we know that was in power in Cyprus before the Trojan War? The only named figure we have is Cinyras. He's not named here, but he would be the logical inference. That could be supported by a couple of other circumstantial details. One is that Kaniris is, in a number of traditions, the sort of darling or priest of Aphrodite, or the lover of Aphrodite, or he builds Aphrodite's temple. He's Aphrodite's representative on the island. And Aphrodite is the patroness of Paris and Helen. She's the one that gives Helen to Paris. She's the one that guides the ship, and so on. So it would not be unreasonable that if they found a receptive host, it would be somebody that was not part of the Greek world, not somebody that was going to join the Greek armada against Troy, but somebody that could act as Aphrodite's agent. Moreover, Kaniris is connected in traditions with seafaring. And, you know, also as the king in power, he would logically be the one to provide ships for a voyage like this. So now all of that might sound pretty speculative, and I suppose it is. However, there's a further support, which is an episode called The Hosting of the Achaeans, which is where we learn of it from Eustathius, who's a Byzantine era commentator on Homer. And this is a different episode in which Menelaus, Odysseus, and Talthybius, the herald of Agamemnon, arrive to Cyprus trying to get ships for the armada. And they are hosted by Kaniris. So he is specified there. So our earlier inference that Kaniris would be the logical person to host Paris and Helen finds a kind of parallel confirmation here, in that when we have heroes arriving to Cyprus and they are in fact hosted by Kaniris. He's the guy that does the hosting in the pre-Trojan War island. And so that episode is also interesting. He promises to send 50 ships to join the Greek fleet. But what happens is he gives one ship and 49 ships made out of clay, which he throws into the harbor. And because of this, he arouses the anger of Agamemnon. And there's some continuities to that curse of Agamemnon that we could come back to later if you like. But what's remarkable about this terracotta fleet episode is that it can be plausibly connected with these famous terracotta ship models that one finds on Cyprus, specifically sometimes both in tombs, but also sometimes in the harbor of Amathus. So it seems to be a very particular Cypriot detail that has an epic story built around it, and that is integrated into the epic cycle because it's part of the raising of the Greek fleet, but the episode happens precisely on Cyprus. So really, really fascinating, obscure situation. The hard evidence that we have, that is the directly attested evidence for Kaniris's involvement, are, first of all, what I just mentioned, the hosting of Menelaus, Odysseus, and Talthybius, and his, you know, lying about, this is why I call him the Liar King, L-I-A-R, lying about sending the ships. So that was an episode. Eustathius knew it. He calls it the hosting of the Achaeans. So that definitely happened. The only other thing we hear about Kaniris is in the Iliad. He is said to have sent a breastplate, a really fancy metalworked breastplate, bronze breastplate with lots of cyan and animal figuration and so on, to Agamemnon as a guest gift, because he had heard from Cyprus about the fleet mustering. But again, that's the Iliad's view of Kaniris. He doesn't appear to be an enemy to the poet of the Iliad, but he also is not part of the Greek armada. He is, he has sent a gift. He has sort of pledged kind of friendship of a sort, but he's not taking part. So that could be two different views of Kaniris's role based on, deriving from two different poets, treating the material in two different ways. The idea that in the hosting of the Achaeans that Eustathius mentions, the idea that Menelaus would come and ask Kaniris for ships, you might logically infer that Kaniris had been one of Helen's suitors, because those are the people that provide the ships going to Troy. That's sort of an open question, but there's some interesting points of contact with that inference. One is an episode in Lucian's True History, one of the sort of, many people call it the first science fiction novel. There's an episode in there in which a figure, a sailor from Cyprus called Kaniris, does in fact abduct Helen in a sort of underworld scene. So it's very weird. It doesn't connect too directly, but has a specific Cypriot connection. It uses the name and it gets itself involved in the question of Helen's abduction. And then there's two medieval European sources that report travelers' tales, travelers who had gone to Cyprus and brought back or reported tales that they picked up there, presumably from, you know, guides or priests at Paphos. And these are really remarkable. We don't know how old they are, but they talk about Helen having been kidnapped on her way to Paphos and the Greek fleet assembling not at Aulis, but at Paphos, because that's where Helen had been kidnapped from. So again, these are what we would call epichoric or local variants. And what happens is that in the archaic period, as different regions told their versions of these traditional stories, they would formulate them according to local interests and local audiences. And so the idea that, you know, that the abduction happened at Paphos or that the Greek fleet assembled there, that makes Cyprus a lot more interesting for a Cypriot audience. Now, these are medieval stories. Maybe they were formulated in the Middle Ages, or maybe they're continued memories of some early version, archaic version of these stories. We can't say. But what they do sort of indicate is this kind of the vitality of these regional variants that it's easy for us to forget about because they get eliminated from the Iliad and the Odyssey. They're not really treated there in any kind of detail. So I know that's a kind of a circuitous answer to your question. We've sort of ended up, once again, awash at a sea of uncertainty.
You mentioned the Curse of Agamemnon. That was right, Curse of Agamemnon?
I call it that, yes.
What is Agamemnon's curse before we move on?
Eustathius, when he says that Cinyras threw the ships into the sea, does say that Agamemnon cursed him. Now, there's an independent source. It's a fragment of Theopompus, who is a 4th century BC historian. And he tells us that that the inhabitants of Amathus are the remnants of the men of Cinyras when Cinyras was driven from the throne by Agamemnon. So, you know, that source doesn't refer to the curse of Agamemnon, but it's, you know, these are two sources that seem to fit together in some way or another. There's a sort of a failure on the part of Cinyras to live up to what Agamemnon expected in Eustathius. And then there is Agamemnon intervening on the island and interrupting the rule of Cinyras. So whether they connect directly or with a couple of steps in between, they seem to be of a piece. And Theopompus was a local historian. I mean, in other words, he was writing a grand history about the house of the Macedonian royal house, but he drew on a lot of local traditions. He was famous for his digressions. So he was probably reporting to us a tradition from Cyprus itself about the unthroning of Cinyras and about the sort of ethnic identity or ethnic self-image or image of others about the Amathusians. So that's how those pieces go together. And it's a super interesting, again, a non-canonical version of Agamemnon's homecoming in that he didn't go straight from Troy back to Mycenae and to be killed by Clytemnestra, but he first stopped on Cyprus to, you know, get even with Cinyras. That's a reasonable inference, right? So that's coherent and logical, but is non-canonical. So that sort of wraps up the curse.
Let's not leave the Liar King here. You've written extensively about him. And when I say liar, I mean L-Y-R-E. Why do you call him the Liar King?
As far as the L-Y-R-E, the Liar King, this gets into a much higher order or broader question of the identity of Cinyras. So far, we've been talking about his integration into stories of the epic cycle and into stories of Greek emigration and Greek immigration into the island. But he's a much older and broader figure. And this was first started being appreciated in the 1950s, early 1960s, with the discovery and publication of tablets from the Syrian coastal city of Ugarit, a late Bronze Age city. These several tablets, they're so-called pantheon lists. They're lists of gods in the pantheon of the city. it's not a canonical list of all our gods. They seem to be ritual texts. So there's sometimes check marks next to the different gods, as though some priest said, okay, I gave the ram to Baal, check. You know, okay, well, who's next in the list? So that seems to be the function of these lists. But down near the bottom of the list, after all the usual gods like Astarte and Baal and Dagon and some of the other Semitic deities that were worshipped at Ugarit, near the bottom of these lists, we find two very curious entries. One is Dingir Gish Kinur. So that the Dingir and Gish, those two words, are determinatives. So in the cuneiform writing system, determinatives are signs which tell you the category of a word which follows. And Dingir means divine or God, and Gish means wood. Then the final word is Kinur. So Kinur certainly means liar. It's the Hebrew word Kinur. It's the Akkadian word Kinaru. And it's clear from its widespread distribution in texts, as well as the widespread distribution of musical iconography, that this word referred to the lyre. Therefore, the two determinatives, meaning God and wood connected to Kinur, confirms that this is a lyre. The lyres are made of wood. Gish is used of musical instruments in Mesopotamian scribal texts all the time. Dingir is used of gods all the time. So it's very clear that this is a divinized wooden musical instrument, which is weird, but we'll come back to that. The second entry is a similar thing, a divinized incense burner. William Albright and others immediately said, oh, well, Caniris and, lyre and divinized incense burner, this is the story of Caniris and his daughter Mira, who is the kind of embodiment of myrrh, which is an agent in making perfumed oils and so on. So what, that's really fascinating, but and very weird from a Greek perspective, these divinized objects. However, when you broaden your focus to include the Mesopotamian material and the Hittite material, the divinization of cult objects is very well attested going back to the third millennium. So we have administrative texts from Mesopotamia recording things like giving 7 liters of oil to the 7 musical instruments. And we have musical instrument names that show they were considered to be servant gods of major gods like Inanna or Ishtar. There's over 100 of these lyre gods or balang gods that are found in Mesopotamian texts. And in my book on Caniris, Wolfgang Hempel, an Assyriologist from Berkeley, contributed an 80-page or so appendix or independent study, really, of all of these divinized musical instrument texts from Mesopotamia. So as weird as it seems to us, this divinized lyre at Ugarit is part of a very well attested and broadly dispersed pattern of cultic ideas and cultic practice. So the real question becomes, and immediately the Semiticists, like Albright, all said, well, look, Ugarit's just across the strait from Ankeme. It's just, it's right there, but you can practically see Cyprus from it. Caniris must be related somehow to this divine lyre. And so my book on Caniris tried to tackle this question. I think I did tackle it successfully on the whole, to show that yes, Caniris can be derived from this divine lyre. What's weird is that Caniris has all these mythological adventures in Greek sources. He's a person. He's a hero. He does things. He like interacts with Agamemnon. He's not an object at all. But again, the Mesopotamian texts come to the rescue because in those sources, including especially something called the Gudea cylinders, divinized objects become personified and act in mythological narratives. So that too is part of the divinized object kind of a phenomenon, is the personification and mythological action. So as weird as it all seems, you can read the book for greater confirmation, but the pieces do fit together pretty well, both conceptually and chronologically, for Caniris being a Bronze Age era kind of presence of some sort on the island. And because I argue that it's his Bronze Age presence as a kind of totalizing cultural symbol that allows him to act within the Greek traditions of the first millennium as a kind of symbol of Cypriot culture and a symbol of the difference between Greek identity and pre-Greek identity. So for instance, a number of place names on the island are derived, I put this the other way around. A number of dictionary sources, lexica, give us the names of eponymous heroes, like we talked about earlier, for place names on the island, like Marion, there's a founder called Marius, and Curius for Curion, that are said to be the children of Caniris. And so this lets us kind of do a map of Caniris-connected Cypriot communities that tend to be concentrated in the southwest along the kind of corridor from Curion up to Marion, and includes kind of Paphos as the epicenter. And these are also, various arguments can be made, increasingly speculative, about the sort of distribution of Greek and pre-Greek communities in the later, within the classical period, and to what extent these communities identified themselves as Greek or pre-Greek, to what extent that was really true, to what extent it was a later kind of construction of the past. Those are all sort of open questions, but I think it's clear enough that Caniris was this figure that was shared across the island by different communities, and some people treated him one way and some people treated him in another way. So for some, he was this faithless ally to Agamemnon, whose breach of promise justified a Greek intervention on the island. To other people, he was this figure of a golden age that invented all of, copper working and all of the typically Cypriot industries. He was a culture hero. And so we find, he's a mediating figure in that sense, in that people could use him for different purposes. But there's sort of a broader Cyprocentric point that can be made about that, which is that our sources, our Greek sources, tend to be from the mainland of Greece. In the Hellenistic period and later, we get some from the east, and that's when Cypriot traditions start entering some of the sources. But in general, from a Greek perspective, Cyprus has always been this kind of exotic, distant place. And it's because of that that it's relatively dark in our sources. It's always a sort of a glancing reference about the weird, distant Cyprus. And similarly, in the Near Eastern sources, because we don't have too many written sources from Cyprus itself. We have, of course, a bunch of inscriptions and so on. I shouldn't say we don't have too many. It's a very rich epigraphic corpus. But in terms of the Caniris question, there's only a few inscriptions from Paphos and relating to the Paphian dynasty. Those are very important. But in the Near Eastern sources more broadly, Cyprus is, again, as in the Greek sources, always the subject of a glancing reference. There's the tablets from, the Amarna archive that tells us about Cyprus or Alashia as a great kingdom, so that we have a lot of evidence from that. But again, it's always from outside of Cyprus that we're looking in. And so, just because things aren't documented in writing from a place doesn't mean they weren't happening. And so what we have to do is try to reconstruct, try to shine light on the darkness on the basis of light from outside, and try to compensate for the distortions that those external perspectives introduce.
So you talk a lot about the Kypriaka. What are these texts that make up the Kypriaka? Because you do mention a lot about a sub-Mycenaean song tradition in Cyprus, which again, skeptics have been hesitant to associate with Cyprus. But you argue that actually, in fact, Cyprus made a sustained thematic contribution to mainstream Aegean epic tradition. So what is that exactly?
Okay, so, well, let's start with the term Kypriaka. Of course, it's just an adjective meaning Cypriot. And so Kypriaka would be things related to Cyprus. And it's a title, it's a typical sort of title that early Greek ethnographers of the 5th, 4th, 3rd century applied to works. So we know that Hellenicus, a 5th century historian, contemporary of Herodotus, wrote a Kypriaka. And we have a few fragments of it. We expect a work like that to deal with local traditions. So now we also find Kypriaka as a title applied sometimes to the poem that we call Kypria. They really kind of mean the same thing, but when you see Kypriaka applied to that poem, it's further support for the idea that the poem did in fact deal with local traditions. Now, in the broader sense of an ethnographic work, we have a half dozen or so works called Kypriaka. I collect them in a footnote in my book. those are all lost except for references and fragments, but those are important evidence that people like Hellenicus, Eratosthenes, Philostephanus were interested in the strange unusual traditions of Cyprus, and they did collect them, and that therefore that material was available to poets like Lycophron or later Nonnus. We can't prove that in every case that they drew on them, but if a tradition is weird and specific, they probably got it from somewhere, and those sources were available. So that's Kypriakos. In terms of a sub-Mycenaean song tradition, it's such a hard period to talk about. You have to talk about circumstantial evidence and plausibility. So we know that there was already hexametric poetry of some sort, so epic poetry, in the Mycenaean period in Greece, because some of the formulas that we find in Homer don't scan metrically unless you restore older linguistic forms into the formulas that do scan. And on the basis of Linear B texts and comparative historical phonology, we can show that those forms that have to be restored are Mycenaean, and in some cases earlier. So we know that already there was epic song in the Mycenaean period. And so that when we find it in Homer, in the Ionian world, or maybe the Aeolian world, and there's a whole question of the Aeolic phase and the Ionian phase we don't need to get into. But when we find it in those regions, there is continuity from the Mycenaean period in some form. So then you have a general circumstantial piece of evidence saying, well, if people came from the Mycenaean world, and to a large extent, it seems, from the Peloponnese to Cyprus, they very well could have brought this tradition also, right? So then another general point would be all cultures have music, right? They do something with sound that's artistic. We have early Iron Age musical iconography. You mentioned the Kuklia Kalathos that has a warrior playing a lyre. This comes from the Paphos region, which is where the famous Opheltos obolos is from, that first attests Greek on the island in the 11th or maybe 10th century. A warrior lyrist as a symbol, as a visual symbol, indicates probably most, sort of the easiest interpretation is that this is a symbol of epic poetry, because you're combining martial deeds with music, and that's the function of epic poetry. Now, does it indicate a sub-Mycenaean one specifically? Well, you can't say for sure. You can say this is the area where the Opheltos obolos was found. That's good. The lyre shape is that you find in the Greek world with a round base, as opposed to the flat base that you find in the Levant, the Phoenician Canaanite world. But as I argued in my book, which came out after the paper we've been talking about, the Cypriot instruments may well have been round-based themselves, so it's, in that case, you can't really distinguish between pre-Greek and, pre-Greek Cypriot instruments and sub-Mycenaean instruments. But again, it could be an example of this sort of sympathetic or receptive world in which sub-Mycenaean emigrants found themselves. So we could talk about hybridity there potentially. So, there's other musical iconography from those early periods to suggest heroic scenes and scenes of musical performance. So it's not implausible that there would be song traditions of narrative content. What did they contain? That's what we don't really know. Like before the 9th and 8th century, when Homeric, the sort of mainstream Greek Aegean Homeric texts and stories started becoming popular also on Cyprus and throughout the Greek world, before that period, which, sort of modulated all the regional traditions, started, attracting them towards this mainstream Greek kind of magnetic center. Before that period, let's say from the 12th century down to the 9th century, what were Cypriot singers singing about? The answer is we don't know. We can make some guesses, but we don't know. However, a couple of other circumstantial pieces of evidence that I think are important. One is that the Cypriot dialect shared a number of linguistic features with mainstream Greek dialect. So for instance, the loss of the labiovelars, the digamma, which is the old W sound, the innovation of a definite article, the merging of the old instrumental case into a five-case system. So in other words, Cypriot dialect was not completely sundered from what was happening in the Aegean. And that implies that there was enough coming and going between the Aegean and Cyprus, even in those quote-unquote dark centuries, 12th, 11th, 10th century, that there was a Greek cultural and linguistic continuum that allowed for parallel linguistic innovations across Cyprus and the Aegean. That's a really important piece of data, I think. And even though it's circumstantial, you could say, look, you've got this continuing linguistic cultural continuum between the island and the mainland. If we reasonably assert that there's musical performance happening, then we would assume that that musical tradition was also sharing or was also co-evolved between those communities across the mainstream and the Cypriot populations. And so I think that environment helps explain very well why you've got episodes of Cypriot and Cyprus region wanderings that Homer already assumed was normal. So already Homer in the 8th century is looking back at an early tradition where that was what you did. That's what Paris and Helen did. They went to the East, just as Greeks emigrated to the East in the after the Bronze Age. I think those wandering stories respond to those popular memories, those popular experiences. They're the heroic version of those population movements. That at least is my take on it.
You mentioned that this sub-Mycenaean survival of a poetic song tradition. Is there any way you can distinguish between survival, revival, and local innovation? Is that something that we're able to do at this point?
You could make more or less plausible cases for any of those three things in any individual case, but never achieve certainty in any individual one, I would say. So for instance, one of the basic problems with saying that the Cypria is from Cyprus is that they're all written in the normal Aeolic, Ionic, Homeric language. They're not written in weird Cypriot dialect forms. So people would look at that and say, okay, this is not evidence for a Cypriot tradition. And we know that as Homeric epic, or the kind of epic that Homer did, as it spread to different regions, people adopted Homer's dialect rather than their own dialect. So Hesiod, for instance, is singing in Homeric dialect, even though he was first from Western Anatolia and then moved to Boeotia. However, there are details and sort of idiosyncrasies in his language that betray his local origin. And sometimes we find metrical inscriptions in other regions that are not purely Homeric, right? So their local people are adopting that poetic idiom, but are, you know, because they're local, it's not their native idiom. Of course, it's an artificial artistic idiom, but they're growing up within a different dialect sphere. And sometimes you can see the imprint of that. It's hard to see. There's not a lot of actual fragments from the Cypria, not a lot to base that kind of analysis on. And so you're sort of stuck with the fact that, okay, let's say Stasinus or Hegesinus were from Salamis and they were composing epic episodes about Cyprus. They're still doing it in this mainstream Greek language. So there's a kind of a glass ceiling there in terms of making those kind of arguments about revival and so on. The one area that we have where we could maybe get into that is the so-called Cypriot glosses. Cypriot glosses are words from dictionaries that say, oh, the Cypriot word for such and such is, you know, they give a Cypriot word for the more ordinary Greek word. And there's four of these that are attributed to somebody called Euclid, who seems to be a Cypriot prophet figure of some sort. The traveler Pausanias apparently had access to a book of his prophecies, because he cites one and he refers to the epae, the verses of Euclid. And so four of these glosses are Cypriot dialect words that were apparently found in oracular verses that were attributed to Euclid. And oracular verses are normally done in dactylic hexameter. That's what the Delphic oracles were composed in. So they're adjacent to epic singing. They use the same language, the same meter. They're a different application of it, but they're part of the same poetic techne. You would have to grow up with the same training to be able to do these kind of oracular verses. So we do have evidence that there was hexametric poetry, which is what we want, from Cyprus using Cypriot dialect words. Now, how do you interpret that? Is that centuries old? Is that going back to the 11th, 10th century, and we just have a few traces surviving? Or is this 5th and 4th century, maybe 6th century Cypriots that are imitating Homer, imitating Delphic oracles, and using Homer's language, but inserting the occasional Cypriot word, as I was talking about earlier, these local versions of the Homeric language that betray their local origin? So in other words, are these only innovations of the later centuries betraying local influence, or are they survivals of a much older insular tradition of heroic / oracular poetry? I'd like it to be that, but you really can't prove it.
John, before we kind of end this podcast, I was hoping you can tell me about the stormy seas of Cyprus.
Okay, yeah.
And I encourage everyone listening right now, just Google that really quick. And there's something really cool that pops up. Can you tell me about it?
Sure. This is a board game that my wife, Glynis Fox, who we met on Cyprus, and she's a archaeological illustrator and artist. We started designing it back, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. And you'll see an article, like a development report, if you Google it. But it takes these Eastern wandering stories as its basis, and it uses the storytelling template of traveling from point A to point B and the different kinds of adventures that might befall you as the basis for a board game. And there's a really interesting match between board games and oral poetics, because the poets had certain kind of storytelling engines. They had certain certain tricks or certain strategies that they resorted to. So for instance, you'd say, oh, I need Menelaus to travel for 7 years. How do I do that? Well, he's trying to get home. A storm comes up. It blows him to Libya. He stops there and he's hosted locally, or he finds miraculous, livestock. He then goes to Egypt and they're hosted by the Egyptian king. And that's where Helen gets the pharmacon that she gives later on in the Odyssey. And then he goes somewhere else, and the local king falls in love with Helen and creates a phantom double and swaps it. So I went through all of the surviving stories that we hear about that are set in the Eastern Mediterranean that are related to Paris and Helen's escape and Menelaus is hunting for them. And I kind of made a typology of all the different kinds of stories that happen. And then I turned those into game mechanics that are, there's a traveling phase that's based on seasonal wind patterns in the region. There's cards that correspond to these different thematic, falling in love with Helen or piracy or storms and so on, divine interventions, single combats, oracular consultations, and I turned it into a board game. It's unfortunately stalled out in development a couple of years ago. My son and I worked on it quite a lot, and we took it to a new level, and we have a pretty nice physical prototype, but it just needs a bunch more play testing before we can sell it at the professional conferences.
That's really cool. Thank you, John. And can't express my appreciation for your time. I hope you have a great weekend, and we'll be in touch.
All right. Thanks so much, Andreas. We'll talk to you soon. All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, John. Take care. Bye.